That much, at least, I owe you for your time. Stephen turned to face Hugh, the eyes in the shadow of the chainmail helm dark and empty, lit by nothing within, reflecting no light from without. I must take precautions. I cannot expect you to accept this task without knowing its nature. Yet to reveal it to you is to place myself at your mercy. I dare not permit you to remain alive, knowing what you will shortly know. If I refuse, I am disposed of by night, in the dark, no witnesses. If I accept, I am entangled in the same web in which your Majesty currently finds himself twisting. What more do you expect? You are, after all, nothing but a murderer, Stephen said coldly. And you, your Majesty, are nothing more than a man who wants to hire a murderer. Bowing with an ironic flourish, Hugh turned on his heel. Where are you going? Stephen demanded. If your Majesty will excuse me, I'm late for an engagement. I should have been in hell an hour previous. The hand walked toward the door. Damn you, I've offered you your life. Hugh didn't even bother to turn around. The price is too low. My life's worth nothing. I don't value it. In exchange, you want me to accept a job so dangerous you've got to trap a man to force him to take it. Better to meet death on my own terms than your Majesty's. Hugh flung open the door. The king's courier stood facing him, blocking his way out. At his feet stood the glow lamp, and it cast its radiance upward, illuminating a face that was ethereal in its delicacy and beauty. He's a courier, and I'm a sartan, Hugh thought. 10,000 barrels, said the young man. Hugh's hand went to the braided beard, twisting it thoughtfully. His eyes glanced sideways at Stephen, who had come up behind him.
Douse that light, commanded the king. Is this necessary, Tryon?
Your Majesty.
Tryon spoke with respect and patience, but it was the tone of one friend advising another, not the tone of a servant deferring to a master.
He is the best. There is no one else to whom we can entrust this. We have gone to considerable trouble to acquire him. We can't afford to lose him. If your Majesty will remember, I warned you from the beginning.
Yes, I remember,
Stephen snapped. He stood silent, inwardly fuming. He would undoubtedly like nothing better than to order his courier to march the assassin to the block. The king would probably at this moment enjoy wielding the executioner's blade himself. The courier gently drew an iron screen over the light, leaving them in darkness.
Very well, the king snarled.
10,000 barrels?
Hugh couldn't believe it.
Yes, answered Tryon. When the job is done.
Half now, half when the job is done.
Your life now, the barrels then,
Stephen hissed through clenched teeth. Hugh took a step toward the door.
Half now.
Stephen's words were a gasp, almost incoherent. Hugh, bowing in acquiescence, turned back to face the king. Who's the victim? Stephen drew a deep breath. Hugh heard a clicking, catching choke in the king's throat, a sound vaguely similar to the rattle in the throats of the dying.
My son, said the king.
Chapter 5. Kyr Monastery, Volcaran Isles, Mid-Realm. Hugh was not surprised. It had to be somebody close to His Majesty to account for all the intrigue and secrecy. The hand knew Stephen had an heir to the throne, nothing more than that. Judging by the king's age, the kid must be 18, 20 cycles, old enough to get into serious trouble.
The prince is here, in the monastery. We...
Stephen paused, trying to moisten a dry tongue.
I've told him his life is in danger. He believes you are a nobleman in disguise, hired to take him to a secret hiding place where he will be safe.
Stephen's voice cracked. Angrily, he cleared his throat and resumed speaking.
The prince will not question this decision. He knows well enough what we say is true. There are those who are a threat to him.
Obviously, said Hugh. The king stiffened, the chainmail clinked, and Stephen's sword rattled in its sheath. The courier, with a whispered,
Restrain yourself, your Majesty,
swiftly interposed his body between that of the king and the assassin.
Remember, sir, whom you are addressing,
Tryon rebuked. Hugh ignored him.
Where am I to take the prince, Majesty? What am I to do with him?
I will provide you with the details,
Tryon answered. Stephen had apparently had enough. His nerve was failing him. He stalked past Hugh toward the door, turning his body slightly so that he avoided touching the assassin. He probably did it unconsciously, but the hand, recognizing the affront, smiled grimly in the darkness and struck back.
There is a service I offer all my clients, Majesty.
Stephen paused, hand on the door handle.
Well?
He did not look around. I tell the victim who is having him killed and why. Shall I so inform your son, Majesty? The chainmail jingled softly. A tremor shook the man's body, but Stephen's head remained unbowed, his shoulders straight. When the moment comes, he said, my son will know. Stiff-backed, straight-shouldered, the king walked into the corridor. Hugh heard his footsteps receding in the distance. The courier moved to stand next to the hand, not speaking until he heard, in the distance, the sound of a door slam shut. There was no call to say that, said Tryon softly. You wounded him deeply. And who is this courier, returned Hugh, who hands out the monies of the royal treasury and worries about a king's feelings? You are right. The young man had turned slightly toward the window, and Hugh could see him smile. I am not a courier. I am the king's magus. Hugh raised an eyebrow. Young, aren't you, Magicka? I am older than I appear, answered Tryon lightly. Wars and kingship age a man. Magic does not. And now, if you will accompany me, I have clothing and supplies for your journey, as well as the information you require. This way. The wizard stood aside to allow Hugh to pass. Tryon's manner was respectful, but the hand noted that the wizard was deftly blocking the corridor down which Stephen had passed with his body. Hugh turned in the direction indicated. Tryon paused to pick up the glow lamp, removed the screen, and walked near Hugh, hovering close at his elbow. You must, of course, look and act the part of a nobleman, and we have provided suitable costume. One reason you were chosen is the fact that you are gently born, though not acknowledged. There is a true air of aristocracy about you that is inbred. The prince is highly intelligent, and would not be fooled by a clod in expensive clothes. After a short walk of no more than 10 steps, the wizard brought Hugh to a halt outside one of the many doors lining the corridor. Using the same iron key, Tryon inserted it into the lock and the door opened. Hugh stepped inside and they traversed a corridor that ran at an angle to the first. This corridor was not as well kept as the former. The walls were crumbling. Footing was treacherous on the cracked floor and both Hugh and the wizard trod carefully and cautiously. Turning left, they entered another corridor. Another left turn brought them to a third. Each successive corridor was shorter than the one previous. They were, Hugh recognized, moving deeper into the building's interior. After this, they began a series of zigs and zags, turns taken seemingly at random. Tryon talked the entire way. It was advisable that we learn all we could about you. I know that you were born on the wrong side of the sheets, following your father's liaison with a serving wench, and that your noble father, whose name, by the way, I was unable to discover, cast your mother out into the streets. She died during the elven attack on Firstfall, and you were taken in and raised by Kyr monks. Tryon shuddered. It must not have been an easy life, he said in a low undertone with a glance at the chill walls that surrounded them. Hugh saw no need to comment and so kept silent. If the wizard thought to confuse or distract him by this conversation and the circumvolved route they were taking, Tryon was not succeeding. Kyr monasteries are built generally along the same plans, a square inner courtyard surrounded on two sides by the monks' cells. On the third side were housed those who served the monks, or, like Hugh, orphans taken in by the order. Here, too, were the kitchens, the study rooms, and the infirmary. The boy lying on the straw pallet on the stone floor tossed and turned. Though it was bitterly cold in the dark, unheated room, the child's skin burned with an unnatural heat, and he had, in his convulsive struggles, thrown aside the thin blanket used to cover his bare limbs. A second boy, some years older than the sick child, who appeared to be about 9 cycles, entered the chamber and stared pityingly down at his friend. In his hands, the elder boy carried a bowl of water. Placing it carefully upon the floor, he knelt beside the sick child, and, dipping his fingers into the water, dabbled the liquid onto the dry, fever-parched lips. This seemed to ease the child's suffering. His thrashing stopped, and his glazed eyes turned to see who cared for him. A wan smile spread over the thin, pale face. The older boy, with an answering smile, tore a piece of fabric from his ragged clothes and placed it in the water. Wringing it out, careful not to waste a drop, he sponged the child's hot forehead. It'll be all right, the older boy started to say, when a dark shadow loomed over them, a cold and bony hand grasped his wrist. End of side one. To continue, turn the cassette over.
Hugh, what are you doing? The voice was chill and dank and dark as the room.
I was helping Rolf, brother. He has the fever, and Gran Mord said that if it didn't break, he'd die.
Die? The voice shook the stone chamber. Of course he will die. It is his privilege to die an innocent child and escape the evil to which mankind is heir, that evil which daily must be scourged from our weak shells. The hand forced Hugh to his knees. Pray, Hugh, pray that your sin in attempting to thwart the ancestors' will by performing the unnatural act of healing be forgiven you. Pray for death.
The sick child whimpered and stared up at the monk in fear. Hugh flung aside the hand that held him down.
I'll pray for death, he said softly, rising to his feet. I'll pray for yours.
The blow of the monk's staff caught Hugh across his upper body. He staggered. The second blow knocked him to the floor. Blows rained down upon the boy's body until the monk grew too tired to lift the weapon. Then he stalked out of the infirmary. The water bowl had been broken during the beating. Bruised and battered, Hugh groped about in the darkness until he found the rag, wet with water or his own blood, he didn't know which. But it was cool and soothing, and he placed it gently on the forehead of his friend. Lifting the thin body in his arms, Hugh held the sick boy close, rocking him awkwardly, soothing him until the body in his arms ceased to twitch and shiver and grew still and cold. At the age of 16, Tryon was continuing, you ran away from the Kyr. The monk to whom I spoke said that before you left, you broke into their record rooms and learned the identity of your father. Did you find him? Yeah, answered the hand, inwardly thinking, so this Tryon has gone to some trouble over me. The Magus has actually been to the Kyr. He has questioned them extensively, it seems, which means... Yes, of course. Now, isn't that interesting? Who will learn more about whom during this little walk?
A nobleman?
Tryon probed delicately.
So he called himself. He was, in reality, how did you phrase it? A clod in expensive clothes.
You speak in the past tense. Your father is dead?
I killed him.
Halting, Tryon stared at him.
You chill me to the bone, to speak of such a thing so carelessly.
Why the hell should I care?
Hugh kept walking, and Tryon had to hurry to catch up.
When the bastard found out who I was, he came at me with his sword. I fought him, barehanded. The sword ended up in his belly. I swore it was an accident, and the sheriff believed me. After all, I was only a boy, and my noble father was well known for his lecherous ways. Girls, youths, it didn't matter to him. I didn't tell anyone who I was, but let them think I was someone my father had abducted. The Kyr had seen to it that I was well-educated. I can sound high-bred when I want to. The sheriff assumed I was some nobleman's son, stolen to feed my father's lust. He was more than willing to hush up the old lecher's death, rather than start a blood feud.
But it wasn't an accident, was it?
A stone turned under Tryon's foot. He reached out instinctively to Hugh, who caught the wizard's elbow and steadied him. They were descending, moving deeper and deeper into the monastery's interior.
No, it wasn't an accident. I wrested the sword from him. It was easy, he was drunk. I spoke my mother's name, told him where she was buried, and stuck the blade in his gut. He died too quick. I've learned since then.
Tryon was pale, silent. Lifting the glow lamp in its iron lantern, he flashed it into Hugh's deeply lined, grim face.
The prince must not suffer, the wizard said.
So, back to business. Hugh grinned at him, and we were having such a pleasant chat. What did you hope to find out? That I'm not as bad as my reputation? Or the opposite, that I'm worse?
Tryon was apparently not to be drawn off onto any side paths. Keeping his hand on Hugh's arm, he leaned close, speaking softly, though the only ones to hear them that the assassin could see were bats.
It must be swift and clean, unexpected, no fear. Perhaps in his sleep. There are poisons.
Hugh jerked his arm from the man's touch.
I know my business. I'll handle it that way if that's what you want. You're the customer. Or rather, I take it you speak for the customer.
That is what we want.
Reassured, sighing, Tryon walked only a short distance further, then halted before another locked door. Instead of opening it, he placed the glow lamp on the floor and indicated with a motion of his hand that Hugh was to look inside. Stooping, placing his eye to the keyhole, the assassin peered into the room. The hand rarely felt a motion of any sort, never showed it. In this instance, however, his bored and disinterested glance through the keyhole at his intended victim sharpened to an intense, narrow-eyed stare.
He was not looking at the plotting, scheming youth of 18 who had sprung from Hugh's reasoning. Curled up on a pallet fast asleep was a tow-headed, wistful-faced child who could not be older than 10. Slowly Hugh straightened. The wizard, lifting the glow lamp, scanned the assassin's face. It was dark and frowning, and Tryon sighed again, his delicate brows creased in worry. Placing a finger on his lips, he led Hugh to another room 2 doors down from the first. He unlocked it with the key, drew Hugh inside, and softly shut the door. "Ah," the wizard said softly, "there's a problem, isn't there?" Hugh gave the room in which they stood a swift and comprehensive glance, then looked back at the anxious Magus. "Yeah, I could use a smoke. They took my pipe away from me in prison. Got another?" Chapter 6. Kyr Monastery, Volkeren Islands, Mid-Realm. "But you frowned. You seemed angry. I assumed..." "That I was feeling squeamish about butchering a small child? It is his privilege to die an innocent child and escape the evil to which mankind is heir." The words came to him from the past. It was this dark and chill room, the cracked stone walls, that brought the memory back to him. Hugh drove it down into the depths of his mind, sorry he'd recalled it. A warming blaze burned in the fire pit. He lifted a coal with the tongs and held it to the bowl of a pipe the Magus had produced from a pack lying on the floor. Stephen, it seemed, had thought of everything. A few puffs and the Sterigo glowed and old memories faded. Footnote. Sterigo is a fungus found on the Isle of Titan. Humans of that land have long used crushed Sterigo as a healing balm. Elven explorers during the first expansion noticed that the slow-burning, pungent Sterigo was far superior to their own pipethorn plant and was less expensive to grow. They transported it to their own plantations, but there is apparently something special about Titan. No other variety can match the original in flavor and aroma. End of footnote. The frown was for myself because I'd made a mistake. I'd misjudged something. That sort of mistake can be costly. I would be interested to know, however, what a kid that age could have done to earn an early death.
"One might say he was born," answered Tryon,
seemingly before he thought, because he cast Hugh a swift, furtive glance to see if he'd heard. There was very little the assassin missed. Hugh paused, the hot coal held over the smoking bowl, and stared quizzically at the wizard. Tryon flushed. "You are being paid well enough not to ask questions," he retorted. "In fact, here is your money." Fumbling in a purse that hung at his side, he produced a handful of coins and counted out 50 100-barrel pieces. "I trust the king's marker will be sufficient," Tryon held it out. Hugh, raising an eyebrow, tossed the coal back into the fire. "Only if I can collect on it." Puffing on the pipe to keep it lit, the hand accepted the money and inspected it carefully. The coins were genuine, all right. A water barrel was stamped on the front, a likeness, though not a good one, of Stephen's head adorned the back. In a realm where most things were obtained by either barter or stealing, the king himself was a notorious pirate whose ravages committed among the elven shipping had helped him win his throne. The double barrel coin, as it was called, was rarely seen, much less used. Its value was exchangeable in the precious commodity, water. Water was scarce in the mid-realm. Rain fell infrequently, and when it did fall, was immediately soaked up and retained by the porous coralite. No rivers or streams ran through the coralite isles. Various plant life growing there trapped water. The cultivation of crystal trees and cup plants was an expensive, laborious means of obtaining the precious liquid. But it was the main source, other than stealing from the elves, of water for the humans of the mid-realm. Footnote. There is an abundance of water in the low realm. Those isles in the heart of a perpetual storm known as the Maelstrom. But no dragon has yet been found who will fly into the Maelstrom. The elves, with their magical, mechanical dragon ships, are able to sail the storm-tossed route and consequently hold a virtual monopoly on water. The prices the elves charge, when they'll sell it to humans at all, are exorbitant. Therefore, the raiding of elven transport ships and of water storage ports is not only financially lucrative for humans, it is a matter of life or death. End of footnote. This job would make Hugh's fortune. He would never have to work again if he chose, and all for killing one little kid. It didn't make sense. Hugh balanced the coins in his hand and stood looking at the wizard. "Very well, I suppose you must know something," Tryon admitted reluctantly. "You are, of course, familiar with the current situation between Volkeren and Eulandia."
"No."
On a small table stood a pitcher, a large bowl, and a mug. Tossing the money on the table, the assassin lifted the water jug and, pouring its contents into the mug, tasted it critically. Low realm stuff, not bad. Water for drinking and washing. You must at least appear to be a nobleman, returned Tryon irritably, in looks and smell. And what do you mean you know nothing of politics? Casting off his cloak, Hugh leaned over the bowl and plunged his face into the water. Laving it over his shoulders, he picked up a bar of lye soap and began to scrub his skin, wincing slightly when the lather stung the raw lash marks on his back. You spend 2 days in Wairani prison and see how you smell. As for politics, they have nothing to do with my business, beyond providing the occasional customer or two. I didn't even know for certain Stephen had a son.
Well, he does. The wizard's voice was cold. And he also has a wife. It is no secret that their marriage is strictly one of convenience, to keep their two powerful nations from going for each other's throats and leaving us at the mercy of the elves. The lady would like very much, however, to have power consolidated in her hands. The crown of Volcaron cannot be passed on to a female, and the only way Anne can take control is through her son. We recently discovered her plot. My king barely escaped with his life this time. We fear he would not annex.
And so you get rid of the kid. That solves your problem, I guess, but leaves your king without an heir.
Pipe clamped firmly between his teeth, Hugh stripped off his pants and splashed water abundantly over his naked body. Tryon turned his back, either from modesty or perhaps sickened by the sight of numerous weals and battle scars, some fresh, that marred the assassin's skin.
Stephen is not a fool. That problem is being resolved. When we declare war upon Aristogon, the nations will unite, including the Queen's own. During the war, Stephen will divorce Anne and marry a woman of Volcaron. Fortunately, His Majesty is of an age that he can still father children, many children. The war will force the nations to remain united, despite Anne's divorce. By the time peace comes, if ever, Ewelandia will be too weakened, too dependent on Stephen to break the ties.
Very clever, Hugh conceded.
Tossing the towel aside, he drank two mugs of the cool, sweet-tasting, low-realm water, then relieved himself in a chamber pot in a corner. Refreshed, he began to look over the various articles of clothing that were folded neatly upon a cot.
And what'll make the elves go to war? They've got their own problems.
I thought you knew nothing of politics, muttered Tryon caustically. The cause of war will be the death of the prince.
Ah.
Hugh drew on the underclothing and the thick woolen hose.
All very neat and tidy. That's why you must trust the deed to me, rather than handle it yourself with a few magics in the castle.
Yes. Tryon's voice broke on the word. He nearly choked. The hand paused in the act of drawing a shirt on over his head to give the Magus a sharp glance. The wizard kept his back turned, however. Hugh's eyes narrowed. Laying the pipe aside, he continued to dress himself, but more slowly, paying keen attention to every nuance of the wizard's words and tone.
The child's body must be found by our people on Aristogon. Not a difficult task. When the word goes forth that the prince has been taken captive by the elves, there will be raiding parties sent to look for him. I will provide you with a list of locations. We understand you have a dragon ship.
Of elven make and design. Isn't that convenient?
Hugh responded.
You had this well thought out, didn't you? Even to the point of framing me for Lord Roger's murder.
Hugh pulled on a velvet doublet, black, braided in gold. A sword lay on the bed. Picking it up, examining it critically, Hugh slid the blade from the sheath and tested it with a quick, deft flick of his wrist. Satisfied, he replaced the blade and buckled the sword belt around his waist. He slipped his dagger into the top of his boot.
And not only framing me for murder, they'd be committing the murder as well?
No, Tryon turned to face him.
The house wizard murdered his lord, as you, I gather, have already guessed. We were on the watch and merely took advantage of the situation. Your dagger was appropriated and substituted for the one in the body. The word was whispered to that knight friend of yours to the effect that you were in the neighborhood.
You let me lay my head on the blood-slimed stone. Let me see that maniac standing above me with his dull sword. And then you save my life and think that fear alone will buy me.
It would have another man. With you I had my doubts, and, as you may have gathered, I had already expressed them to Stephen.
So I take the kid to Aristogon, murder him, leave the body for the grieving father to find, who then shakes his fist and vows vengeance on the elves, and all humankind marches off to war. Won't it occur to someone that the elves aren't really that stupid? They don't need war with us right now. This rebellion of theirs is serious business.
You seem to know more about the elves than you do your own people. Some might find that interesting.
Some might, who don't know that I have to have my ship overhauled by elven shipbuilders, and that its magic must be renewed by elven wizards.
So you trade with the enemy?
Hugh shrugged. In my business, everyone's an enemy. Tryon licked his lips. The discussion was obviously leaving a bitter taste in his mouth. But that's what happens, thought Hugh, when you drink with kings.
The elves have been known to capture humans and taunt us by leaving the bodies where they may easily be discovered, Tryon said in a low voice. You should arrange matters so that it appears...
I know how to arrange matters. Hugh placed his hand on the wizard's shoulder and had the satisfaction of feeling the young man flinch. I know my business. Reaching down, he picked up the coins, studied them again, then dropped two into a small inner pocket of the doublet. The remainder he tucked away carefully into his money pouch and stored that in a pack. Speaking of business, how will I contact you for the rest of my pay? And what assurance do I have that I'll find it and not a feathered shaft in my ribs when I return?
You have our word, the word of a king. As for the feathered shaft...
Now it was Tryon who experienced satisfaction.
I assume you can take care of yourself?
I can, said Hugh. Remember that.
A threat,
Tryon sneered. A promise. And now, said the hand coolly... We'd best get going. We'll need to do our traveling by night.
The dragon will take you to where your ship is moored, and then
return and tell you the location. Hugh raised an eyebrow. No.
You have our word.
Hugh smiled. The word of a man who hires me to murder his child. The young wizard flushed in anger.
Do not judge him. You cannot understand.
Biting his tongue, he silenced himself. Understand what? Hugh flashed him a sharp, narrow-eyed glance.
Nothing. You said yourself you have no interest in politics.
Tryon swallowed.
Believe what you want of us. It makes little difference.
Hugh eyed him speculatively, decided that no more information would be forthcoming. Tell me where we are, and I will find my way from here.
Impossible. This fortress is secret. We worked many years to make it a safe retreat for His Majesty.
Ah, but you have my word, Hugh mocked. It seems we're at an impasse. Tryon flushed again, his teeth clenched over his lips so tightly that when at last he spoke, Hugh could see white marks upon the flesh.
What of this? You provide me with a general location, say the name of an isle. I'll instruct the dragon to take you and the prince to a town on that isle and leave you. That's the best I can do.
Hugh considered this, then nodded in agreement. Knocking the ashes from the pipe, he tucked the long, curved stem with its small rounded bowl into the pack and inspected the remainder of the pack's contents. He evidently approved what he saw, for he cinched it tightly.
The prince carries his own food and clothing, enough for...
Tryon faltered, but forced the words out for a month. It shouldn't take that long, said the hand easily, throwing the fur cloak over his shoulders. Depending on how close this town is to where we're bound, I can hire dragons.
The prince must not be seen. There are few who know him outside of the court, but if by chance he were recognized...
Relax. I know what I'm doing, Hugh said softly, but there was a warning in the black eyes that the wizard thought best to heed. Hugh hefted the pack and started for the door. Movement glimpsed from the corner of an eye drew his attention. Outside of the courtyard, he saw the king's executioner bow in apparent response to some unheard command, and then quit his post. The block alone remained standing in the courtyard. It gleamed with a white light, strangely inviting in its coldness and purity and promise of escape. The hand paused. It was as if he felt, for a brief instant, the invisible filament cast out by fate wrap itself around his neck. It was tugging him away, dragging him on, entangling him in the same vast web in which Tryon and the king were already struggling. One swift, clean stroke of the sword would free him. One stroke against 10,000 barrels. Twisting the braid of his beard, Hugh turned to face Tryon. What token shall I send to you?
Token?
Tryon blinked, not understanding. To indicate the job is done. An ear? A finger? What?
Blessed ancestors forfend!
The young wizard was deathly white. He swayed unsteadily on his feet and was forced to lean against a wall to retain his balance. And so he did not see Hugh's lips tighten in a grim smile, the assassin's head incline ever so slightly, as if he'd just received an answer to a very important question.
Please forgive this weakness.
Tryon muttered, brushing a shaking hand across his damp skin.
I haven't slept in several nights, and then the dragon ride up Ridai and back again in such haste. Naturally, we want a token. The prince wears... Tryon gulped, and then suddenly seemed to find some inner reserve of strength. The prince wears an amulet, the feather of a hawk. It was given him when he was a babe by a mysteriarch from the High Realm. Due to its magical properties, the amulet cannot be removed unless the prince is... Here Tryon faltered once again. Dead. He drew a deep, shivering breath. Send us this amulet and we will know. His voice trailed off.
What magic? Hugh asked suspiciously.
But the wizard, pale as death, was silent as death. He shook his head, whether physically unable to speak or refusing to answer, Hugh couldn't tell. At any rate, it was obvious he wasn't going to find out any more about the prince or his amulet. It probably didn't matter. Such magically blessed objects were commonly given to babes to protect them from disease or rat bites or keep them from tumbling headfirst into the fire pit. Most of the charms sold by roaming charlatans had as much magical power in them as did the stone beneath Hugh's feet. A king's son, of course, was likely to have a real one, but Hugh knew of none, even those with true power, who could protect a person from, say, having his throat cut. Long ago, so legend told, there had been wizards who possessed such skill in their art, but not now. Not for many years since they had left the mid-realm and gone to dwell on the isles that floated high above. And one of these wizards had come down and given the kid a feather. This Tryon must take me for a real fool.
Pull yourself together, wizard, said Hugh harshly, or the kid will suspect.
Tryon nodded and gratefully drank the mug of water the assassin poured for him. Closing his eyes, the wizard drew several deep breaths, centered himself, and within a few moments managed to smile calmly and normally. Color returned to his ashen cheeks. I am ready now, Tryon said, and led the way down the corridor to the chamber where the prince lay sleeping. Inserting the key in the lock, the wizard silently opened the door and stepped back. Farewell, Tryon said, tucking the key into the breast of his doublet.
Aren't you coming to introduce me?
Explain what's going on? Tryon shook his head. No, he said softly. He was, Hugh noted, careful to keep his gaze straight ahead, not so much as glancing into the room. It is now in your hands. I'll leave you the lamp. Turning on his heel, the wizard practically fled down the corridor. He was soon lost in the shadows. Hugh's sharp ears caught the sound of a lock click. There was a rush of fresh air, swiftly shut off. The wizard was gone. Shrugging, fingering the two coins in his pocket with one hand, the other reassuringly touching the hilt of his sword, the assassin entered the chamber. Holding the lamp high, he shone it on the child. The hand cared nothing for and knew less about children. He had no memory of his own childhood. Little wonder it had been brief. The Kier monks had no use for the state of blissful, carefree, childish innocence. Early on, each child was exposed to the harsh realities of living. In a world in which there were no gods, the Kier worshipped life's only certainty, death. Life came to mankind haphazardly, at random. There was no choice, no help for it. Joy taken in such a dubious gift was seen to be a sin. Death was the bright promise, the happy release. As part and parcel of their belief, the Kier performed those tasks which most other humans found offensive or dangerous. The Kier were known as the Brothers of Death. They had no mercy for the living. Their province was the dead. They did not practice healing arts, but when the corpses of plague victims were tossed out into the street, it was the Kier who took them, performed the solemn rites, and burned them. Paupers who were turned from the doors of the Kier when they were alive gained entrance after death. Suicides, cursed by the ancestors, a disgrace to their families, were welcomed by the Kier, their bodies treated with reverence. The bodies of murderers, prostitutes, thieves, all were taken in by the Kier. After a battle, it was the Kier who tended to those who had sacrificed their lives for whatever cause was currently in vogue. The only living beings to whom the Kier extended any charity at all were male children of the dead, orphans who had no other refuge. The Kier took them in and educated them. Wherever the monks went, to whatever scene of misery and suffering, cruelty and deprivation, they were called upon to attend. They took the children with them, using them as their servants, and at the same time teaching them about life, extolling the merciful benefits of death. By raising these boys in their ways and grim beliefs, the monks were able to maintain the numbers of their dark order. Some of the children, like Hugh, ran away, but even he had not been able to escape the shadow of the black hoods under whose tutelage he had been reared. Consequently, when the hand gazed down at the sleeping face of the young child, he felt no pity, no outrage. Murdering this boy was just another job to him, and one that was likely to prove more difficult and dangerous than most. Hugh knew the wizard had been lying. Now he only had to figure out why.
Tossing his pack on the floor, the assassin used the toe of his boot to nudge the child.
Kid, wake up.
The boy started, his eyes flared open, and he sat up, reflexively, before he was truly awake.
What is it?
He asked, staring through a mass of tousled golden curls at the stranger standing above him.
Who are you?
I'm known as Hugh, Sir Hugh of Caliph,
Your Highness,
said the hand, remembering in time he was supposed to be a nobleman, and naming the first land-holding that came to his mind. You're in danger. Your father has hired me to take you to some place where you'll be safe. Get up. Time is short. We must leave while it is still night. Looking at the impassive face with its high cheekbones, hawk nose, braided strands of black beard hanging from the cleft chin, the child shrank back amidst the straw.
Go away. I don't like you. Where is Tryon? I want Tryon.
I'm not pretty like the wizard, but your father didn't hire me for my looks. If you're frightened of me, think how your enemies will feel. Hugh said this glibly just for something to say. He was prepared to pick up the kid, kicking and screaming, and carry him off bodily. He was therefore somewhat surprised to see the child consider this argument with an expression of grave and keen intelligence.
You make sense, Sir Hugh, the boy said, rising to his feet. I will accompany you. Bring my things.
He waved a small hand at a pack lying next to him on the straw. It was on Hugh's tongue to tell the kid to bring his own things, but he recalled himself in time. Yes, Your Highness, he said humbly, bending down. He took a close look at the child. The prince was small for his age, with large pale blue eyes, a sweetly curved mouth, and the porcelain white complexion of one who is kept protectively within doors. The light glistened off a hawk feather hanging from a silver chain around the child's neck.
Since we are to be traveling companions, you may call me by my name, said the boy shyly.
And what might that be, Your Highness? Hugh asked, lifting the pack. The child stared at him. The hand added hastily, I've been out of the country many years, Your Highness.
Bane, said the child. I am Prince Bane.
Hugh froze, motion arrested. Bane? The assassin wasn't superstitious, but why would anyone give a child such an ill-omened name? Hugh felt the invisible filament of fate's web tighten around his neck. The image of the block came to him, cold, peaceful, serene. Angry at himself, he shook his head. The choking sensation vanished. The image of his own death disappeared. Hugh shouldered the prince's pack and his own.
We must be going, Your Highness, he said again, nodding toward the door.
Bane lifted his cloak from the floor and threw it clumsily over his shoulders, fumbling at the strings that fastened it around his neck. Impatient to be gone, Hugh tossed the packs back to the ground, knelt, and tied the strings of the cloak. To his astonishment, the prince flung his arms around his neck.
I'm glad you're my guardian,
he said, clinging to him, his soft cheek pressed against Hugh's. The hand held rigid, unmoving. Bane slipped away from him.
I'm ready, he announced in eager excitement. Are we going by dragon? Tonight was the first time I'd ever ridden one. I suppose you must ride them all the time.
Yes, Hugh managed to say. There's a dragon in the courtyard. He lifted the two packs and the lamp. If Your Highness will follow me...
I know the way, said the prince, skipping out of the room.
Hugh followed after him, the touch of the boy's hand soft and warm against his skin. Chapter 7. Kyr Monastery, Volker and Isles, Mid-Realm. Three people were gathered in a room located in the upper levels of the monastery. The room had been one of the monk's cells, and was, consequently, cold, austere, small, and windowless. The three, two men and one woman, stood in the very center of the room. One man had his arm around the woman. The woman had her arm around him, each supporting the other, or it seemed both might have fallen. The third stood near them.
They are preparing to leave.
The wizard had his head cocked, though it was not with his physical ear he heard the beating of the dragon's wings through the thick walls of the monastery.
Leaving,
the woman cried and took a step forward.
I want to see him again, my son, one more time.
No, Anne.
Tryon's voice was stern. His hand clasped hold of the woman's and held it firmly.
It took long months to break the enchantment. It is easier this way. You must be strong.
I pray we have done right.
The woman sobbed and turned her face to her husband's shoulder.
You should have gone along, Tryon, said Stephen.
He spoke harshly, though the hand with which he stroked his wife's hair was gentle and loving.
There is still time.
No, Your Majesty. We gave this matter long and careful consideration. Our plans are sound. We must follow through on them and pray that our ancestors are with us and all goes as we hope.
Did you warn this, Hugh?
A hard man such as that assassin would not have believed me. It would have done no good and might have caused a great deal of harm. He is the best. He is cold, he is heartless. We must trust in his skill and his nature. And if he fails? Then, Your Majesty, said Tryon with a soft sigh, we should prepare ourselves to face the end.
Chapter 8. Het Drevlin, Low Realm. At almost precisely the same time Hugh laid his head on the block in Caliph, another execution, that of the notorious Limbeck Bolt Tightener, was being carried out thousands of Menker below on the Isle of Drevlin. Footnote. Menker, or more precisely, Mencarius Ridi, is the elven standard form of measurement. Classically, it was said to be 1,000 elf hunters high. In modern times, this has been standardized by establishing that elf hunters are 6 feet tall, thus making the Menker equal to 6,000 feet. This has led to considerable confusion between the races, due to the fact that elven feet are somewhat smaller than those of humans. End of footnote. It would seem at first that these executions had nothing in common except the coincidence of their time. But the invisible threads cast by that immortal spider, Fate, had just wrapped around the soul of each of these oddly disparate people, and would slowly and surely draw them together. On the night that Lord Roger of Caliph was murdered, Limbeck Bolt-Tightener was seated in his cozy, untidy dwelling in Het, the oldest city on Drevlin, composing a speech. Limbeck was, in his own language, a geg. In any other language, in Arianus, or in the ancient world before the Sundering, he would have been known as a dwarf. He stood a respectable 4 feet in height, without shoes. A full and luxuriant growth of beard adorned a cheerful, open face. He was developing a slight paunch, unusual in a hard-working young adult geg, but that was due to the fact that he sat a great deal. Limbeck's eyes were bright, inquisitive, and extremely nearsighted. He lived in a small cavern amid hundreds of other caverns that honeycombed a large mound of coralite located on the outskirts of Het. Limbeck's cave was different in certain respects from those of his neighbors, which seemed fitting since Limbeck himself was certainly an unusual geg. His cave was taller than the others, being almost 2 gegs high. A special platform built of knobwood planks allowed Limbeck to climb up to the ceiling of his dwelling and enjoy another of the cavern's oddities, windows. Most gegs didn't need windows. The storms that buffeted the isle made windows impractical, and in general the gegs were far more concerned with what was going on inside than outside. A few of the city's original buildings, the ones that had been built long, long ago by the hallowed and revered Mangers, had windows, however. Small panes of thick, bubble-filled glass set into recessed holes in the sturdy walls, the windows were perfectly suited to a lifetime of battering wind, rain, and hail. It was windows such as these that Limbeck had confiscated from an unused building in the center of town and transported to his cavern. A few turns of a borrowed boar hugus created the perfect size openings for 2 windows on the ground floor and 4 more up above. In this, Limbeck established the major difference between himself and the majority of his people. They looked only within. Limbeck liked to look without. Even if looking without only brought visions of slashing rain and hail and lightning, or, during those brief periods when the storms subsided, the vat things and hummer coils and blazing bluesusts of the Kixie Winsie. One other feature of Limbeck's dwelling made it positively unique. On the front door, which faced the interior of the mound and its interconnecting streets, was a sign with the letters WUPP painted in red, marching along boldly at a definite uphill slant. In all other aspects, the dwelling was a typical geg dwelling. The furniture was functional and made out of whatever material the gegs could find. There were no frivolous decorations. None could be found that would stay put. The walls and floors and ceiling of the snug cavern shook and quivered with the thumping, throbbing, whumping, zizzed, crackle, and clanging of the Kixie Winsie, the dominant feature, the dominant force on Drevlin. Limbeck, the august leader of WUP, did not mind the noise. He took comfort in it, having listened to it, albeit somewhat muffled, in his mother's womb. The gegs revered the noise, just as they revered the Kixie Winsie. They knew that if the noise ceased, their world would come to an end. Death was known among the gegs as the endless hear-nothing. Wrapped in the comforting banging and drumming, Limbeck struggled with his speech. Words came easily to him, writing them down did not. What sounded fine and grand and noble when it came out of his mouth looked trite and pretentious when he saw it on paper. At least it did to Limbeck. Jara always told him he was far too critical of himself, that his speeches read just as well as they sounded. But as Limbeck always replied with a fond kiss on her cheek, Jara was prejudiced. Limbeck talked aloud as he wrote, in order to hear his words spoken. Being extremely nearsighted and finding it difficult to focus properly when he wore his spectacles, Limbeck invariably took them off when writing. His face pressed close to the paper, his quill scratching away, he got nearly as much ink up his nose and down his beard as he did on his speech.
It is therefore our purpose, as worshippers united for progress and prosperity, to bring to our people a time of good living now, not sometime in the future that may never come.
Limbeck, carried away, banged his fist on the table, sloshing ink out of the inkwell. A small river of blue crept toward the paper, threatening to inundate the speech.
It is therefore our purpose, as worshippers united for progress and prosperity, to bring to our people a time of good living now, not sometime in the future that may never come.
Limbeck, carried away, banged his fist on the table, sloshing ink out of the inkwell. A small river of blue crept toward the paper, threatening to inundate the speech. Limbeck stemmed the tide with his elbow. His frayed tunic soaked up the ink thirstily. Since the tunic had long ago lost any color it might have once possessed, the purple splotch on the sleeve was a cheerful improvement.
For centuries we have been told by our leaders that we were placed in this realm of storm and chaos because we were not deemed worthy to take our place with the wells above. We, who are flesh and blood and bone, could not hope to live in the land of the immortals. When we are worthy, our leaders tell us, then the wells will come from above and pass judgment on us, and we shall rise up into the heavens. In the meantime, it is our duty to serve the Kixi-Winzi and wait for that great day. I say,
here Limbeck raised a clenched and inky fist above his head,
I say that day will never come. I say that we have been lied to, our leaders deluded. It is easy enough for the high Froman and the people of his script to talk of waiting for change until judgment comes. They do not need a better life. They receive the gods' payment. But do they disperse it equally among us? No, they make us pay, and pay dearly for our share that we have already earned by the sweat of our brow.
I must pause here for cheering, Limbeck decided, and put a blot that was supposed to be a star to mark the place.
It is time to rise up and...
Limbeck hushed, thinking he heard a strange sound. Now, how anyone could hear anything in this land other than the noise of the Kixi-Winzi and the buffeting and roaring of the storms that swept daily over Drevlin was a mystery to the wells who came monthly for their shipment of water. But the Geggs, accustomed to the deafening noises, minded them no more than the rush of air through the leaves of a tree would bother an elf lord of Tribus. A Gegg could sleep soundly through a ferocious thunderstorm and start bolt upright to the rustle of a mouse in his pantry. It was the sound of distant shouting that aroused Limbeck's attention, and, stricken by sudden consciousness, he peered up at a timekeeping device, his own invention, set in a hollow of the wall. A complex combination of whirly wheels and spoky spikes, the device dropped one bean every hour on the hour into a jar below. Each morning, Limbeck emptied the jar of beans into the funnel above, and the measuring of the day began again. Leaping to his feet, Limbeck peered nearsightedly into the jar, hastily counting up the beans. He groaned. He was late. Grabbing a coat, he was heading out the door when, at that moment, the next line in his speech occurred to him. He decided to take just a second to record it and sat back down. All thoughts of his appointment went clean out of his mind. Ink bedaubed and happy, he once more lost himself in his rhetoric.
We, the worshippers united for progress and prosperity, advocate three tenets. The first, all of the scripts should come together and pool their knowledge of the Kixi-Winzi and learn how it operates, so that we become its masters, not its slaves.
Blot for cheering.
The second, worshippers quit waiting for a day of judgment and start to work now to better the quality of their own lives.
Another blot.
The third, worshippers should go to the Froman and demand a fair share in the well's payment.
Two blots and a scribble. At this juncture, Limbeck sighed. He knew from past experience that his third tenet would be the most popular with the young Geggs, impatient over serving long hours for inadequate pay. But of the three, Limbeck himself knew it to be the least important.
If only they had seen what I saw, Limbeck mourned. If only they knew what I know. If only I could tell them.
The sound of shouting broke in on his thoughts again. Raising his head, Limbeck smiled with fond pride. Jara's speech was having its usual effect. She doesn't need me, Limbeck reflected, not sadly, but with the pleasure of a teacher who takes pride in seeing a promising student blossom. She's doing fine without me. I'll just go ahead and finish. During the next hour, Limbeck, smeared with ink and inspiration, was so absorbed in his project that he no longer heard the shouts and therefore did not notice that they changed in tone from cheers of approval to roars of anger. When a sound other than the monotonous whump and whuzzle of the Kixi-Winzi did finally attract his attention, it was only because it was the sound of a door banging. Occurring some 3 feet away from him, it startled him immensely.
"Is that you, my dear?"
he said, seeing a dark and shapeless blur that he assumed was Jara. She was panting as if from an undue amount of exertion. Limbeck patted his pocket for his glasses, couldn't find them, and groped with his hand over the table.
I heard the cheers. Your speech went well tonight, I gather. I'm sorry I wasn't there as I promised, but I got involved.
He waved a vague and ink-splattered hand at his work. Jara pounced on him. The Geggs are small in stature, but wide of girth, with large, strong hands and a tendency to square jaws and square shoulders that give a general overall impression of squareness. Male and female Geggs are equally strong, since all serve the Kixi-Winzi until the marrying age of about 40 years, when both are required to retire and stay home to bear and raise the next generation of Kixi-Winzi worshippers. Jara was stronger even than most young women, having served the Kixi-Winzi since she was 12. Limbeck, not having served it at all, was rather weak. Consequently, when Jara pounced on him, she nearly carried him out of his chair.
"My dear, what is the matter?"
Limbeck said, gazing at her myopically, aware for the first time that something was the matter.
"Didn't your speech go well?"
"Yes, it went well. Very well,"
Jara said, digging her hands into his tattered and ink-stained tunic and attempting to drag him to his feet.
"Come on, we've got to get you out of here."
"Now?"
Limbeck blinked at her.
"But my speech..."
"Yes, that's a good idea. We shouldn't leave it behind for evidence."
Letting loose of Limbeck, Jara hastily caught up the sheets of paper that were a byproduct, no one knew why, of the Kixi-Winzi, and began stuffing them down the front of her gown.
"Hurry, we haven't much time."
She glanced around the dwelling hastily.
"Is there anything else lying around that we should take?"
"Evidence?"
questioned Limbeck, bewildered, searching for his glasses.
"Evidence of what?"
"Of our union,"
said Jara impatiently. Cocking an ear, she listened and ran over to peer fearfully out one of the windows.
"But, my dear, this is Union headquarters,"
began Limbeck when she shushed him.
"There, hear that? They're coming."
Reaching down, she picked up his glasses and stuck them hastily and at a precarious slant on his nose.
"I can see their lanterns, the coppers. No, not the front, the back door, the way I came in."
She began to push and hustle Limbeck along. Limbeck stopped, and when a Geg stops dead in his tracks, it is almost impossible to shift or budge him.
"I'm not going anywhere, my dear, until you tell me what's happened."
He calmly adjusted his spectacles. Jara wrung her hands, but she knew the Geg she loved. Limbeck had a stubborn streak in him that not even the Kixi-Winzi could have knocked out. She had learned to overcome this on former occasions by moving fast and not giving him time to think, but seemingly that wasn't going to work tonight.
"Oh, very well," she said in exasperation, her eyes darting constantly to the front door. "We had a big crowd at the rally, bigger than anything we'd expected."
"That's marvelous."
"Don't interrupt. There isn't time. They listened to my words and, oh, Limbeck, it was so wonderful."
Despite her impatience and fear, Jara's eyes shone.
"It was like setting a match to saltpeter. They flared up and exploded."
"Exploded?"
Limbeck began to get uneasy.
"My dear, we don't want them to explode."
"You don't," she said scornfully. "But now it's too late. The fire's burning, and it's up to us to guide it, not try to put it out again."
Her fist clenched, her square chin jutted forward.
"Tonight we attack the Kixi-Winzi."
"No!"
Limbeck stared aghast. So shaken was he by this news that he sat down quite suddenly and unexpectedly.
"Yes, and I think we damaged it permanently."
Jara shook her thick mane of short-cut, curly brown hair.
"The coppers and some of the clerks rushed us, but all of our people escaped. The coppers will be coming to the Union headquarters in search of you, my dear, and so I came to take you away. Listen."
Sounds of blows could be heard hammering on the front door. Hoarse voices were shouting to open up.
"They're here. Quickly. They probably don't know about the back."
"They're here to take me into custody?"
Limbeck said, pondering. Jara, not liking the expression on his face, frowned and tugged at him, trying to pull him back up on his feet.
"Yes, now come."
"I'll stand trial, won't I?" he said slowly. "Most likely before the High Froman himself."
"Limbeck, what are you thinking?"
Jara had no need to ask. She knew all too well.
"Punishment for hurting the Kixi-Winzi is death."
Limbeck brushed this aside as a minor consideration. The voices grew louder and more persistent. Someone called for a chopper cutter.
"My dear,"
said Limbeck, a look of almost holy radiance illuminating his face,
"at last I'll have the audience I've sought all my life. This is our golden opportunity. Just think, I'll be able to present our cause to the High Froman and the Council of the Clans. There'll be hundreds present, the news singers and the squawky talk."
The blade of the chopper cutter smashed through the wooden door. Jara turned pale.
"Oh, Limbeck, this is no time to play at being a martyr. Please come with me now."
The chopper cutter wrenched itself free, disappeared, then smashed through the wood again.
"No, you go ahead, my dear,"
said Limbeck, kissing her on the forehead.
"I'll stay. I've made up my mind."
"Then I'll stay, too,"
Jara said fiercely, entwining her hand around his. The chopper cutter crashed into the door, and splinters flew across the room.
"No, no," Limbeck shook his head. "You must carry on in my absence. When my words and my example inflame the worshippers, you must be there to lead the revolution."
"Oh, Limbeck," Jara wavered, "are you sure?"
"Yes, my dear."
"Then I'll go.
But we'll spring you."
She hastened to the doorway, but could not forbear pausing for one final glance behind her.
"Be careful," she pleaded.
"I will, my dear. Now go."
Limbeck made a playful, shooing motion with his hand. Blowing him a kiss, Jara disappeared through the back door just as the coppers crashed through the splintered door in the front. "We're looking for one Limbeck Bolt-Tightener," said a copper, whose dignity was somewhat marred by the fact that he was plucking splinters of wood out of his beard.
"You have found him," said Limbeck majestically.
Thrusting out his hands, wrists together, he continued,
"As a champion of my people, I will gladly suffer any torture or indignity in their names. Take me to your foul-smelling, blood-encrusted, rat-infested dungeon."
"Foul-smelling?" The copper was highly incensed. "I'll have you know, we clean our jail regular. And as for rats, there ain't been one seen there in 20 years, has there, Fred?" He appealed to a fellow copper who was crashing through the broken door. "Ever since we brought in the cat. And we washed up the blood from last night when Durkin Wrenchwielder come in with a split lip on account of a fight with Mrs. Wrenchwielder. You've no call," added the copper testily, "to go insulting my jail."
I'm very sorry," stammered Limbeck, taken aback. "I had no idea."
"Now come along with you," said the copper. "What have you got your hands stuck in my face for?
Aren't you going to shackle me, bind me hand and foot?
And how would you walk? I suppose you'd expect us to carry you."
The copper sniffed. "A pretty sight we'd look, hauling you through the streets. And you're no lightweight, neither. Put your hands down. The only pair of manacles we had busted some 30 years ago. We keep them for use when the young'uns get out of hand. Sometimes parents like to borrow them to throw a scare into the little urchins."
Having been threatened with those manacles often in his own turbulent urchinhood, Limbeck was crushed.
"Another illusion of youth fled,"
he said to himself sadly as he allowed himself to be led away to a prosaic, cat-patrolled prison. Martyrdom was not starting out well. Chapter 9. Het to Wom, Drevlin, Low Realm. Limbeck was looking forward to the flash raft ride across Drevlin to the capital city of Wom. He had never ridden a flash raft before. Nobody in his script had, and there were more than a few mutterings among the crowd about common criminals getting privileges to which ordinary citizens weren't entitled. Somewhat hurt at being referred to as a common criminal, Limbeck climbed up the steps and entered what resembled a gleaming brass box fitted with windows and perched on numerous metal wheels that ran along a metal track. Taking his spectacles from his pocket, Limbeck hooked the frail wire stems over his ears and peered at the crowd. He easily located Jara among the throng, though her head and face were hidden in the shadows of a voluminous cloak. It was too dangerous for any sort of sign to pass between them, but Limbeck did not think it would hurt if he brought his thick fingers to his lips and blew her a small kiss. A couple standing alone at the far end of the platform caught his attention, and he was astounded to recognize his parents. At first it touched him that they would come to see him off. However, a glimpse of his father's smiling face, half hidden by a gigantic muffler he had wound around his neck to ensure that no one knew him, made Limbeck understand that his parents had not come out of filial devotion, but probably to make certain they were actually seeing the last of a son who had brought them nothing but turmoil and disgrace. Sighing, Limbeck settled back in the wooden seat. The flash raft's driver, commonly known as a flasher, glared back at his two passengers, Limbeck and the copper who accompanied him, in the only compartment on the vehicle. This unusual stop in the station of Het had put the flasher way behind schedule, and he didn't want to waste any more time. Seeing Limbeck start to stand up, the geg thought he saw his old teacher in the crowd. The flasher threw both sections of his carefully parted beard over his shoulders, grasped two of the many tin hands before him, and pulled. Several metal hands sticking from out of the compartment's roof reached out and grabbed hold of a cable suspended above them. An arc of blue lightning flared, a whistle toot shrilled loudly, and amidst crackling zusts of electricity, the flash raft jolted forward. The brass box rocked and swayed back and forth. The hands above them that clung to the cable sparked alarmingly, but the flasher never seemed to notice. Grasping another tin hand, he pushed it clear to the wall, and the vehicle picked up speed. Limbeck thought he had never in his life experienced anything so marvelous. The flash raft was created long ago by the Mangers for the benefit of the Kixie-Winsie. When the Mangers mysteriously disappeared, the Kixie-Winsie took over the operation and kept the flash raft alive just as it kept itself alive. The Gegs lived to serve both. Each Geg belonged to a Skrift, a clan that had lived in the same city and had worshipped the same part of the Kixie-Winsie since the Mangers first brought the Gegs to this realm.
Each Geg performed the same task his father performed before him, and his grandfather before him, and his grandfather before him. The Gegs did their work well. They were competent, skilled, and dexterous, but unimaginative. Each Geg knew how to serve his or her particular part of the Kixi-Winzi and had no interest in any other part. Further, he never questioned the reasons for doing what he did. Why the whirly wheel had to be turned, why the black arrow of the whistle toot should never be allowed to point to red, why the pull arm needed to be pulled, the push arm pushed, or the cranky clank cranked, were questions that did not occur to the average Geg. But Limbeck was not an average Geg. Delving into the whys and wherefores of the great Kixi-Winzi was blasphemous and would call down the wrath of the clerks, the ecclesiastical force on Drevlin. Performing his or her act of worship as taught by the script teachers and doing it well was the height of ambition from most Gegs. It would gain them, or their children, a place in the realms above, but not Limbeck. After the novelty of moving at a terrific rate of speed wore off, Limbeck began to find riding in the flash raft extremely depressing. The rain dashed against the windows. Natural lightning, not the blue lightning created by the Kixi-Winzi, streaked down from the swirling clouds and occasionally fought the blue lightning, causing the brass box to buck and jolt. Hail clattered on the roof, lumbering around, beneath, above, and through huge sections of the Kixi-Winzi. The flash raft seemed to be smugly exhibiting, to Limbeck at least, the enslavement of the Gegs. The flames from gigantic furnaces lit the oppressive and everlasting gloom. By their light, Limbeck could see his people, nothing more than squat, dark shadows against the glowing red, tending to the Kixi-Winzi's needs. The sight stirred an anger in Limbeck, an anger that he realized remorsefully had been banked and nearly allowed to die out as he'd grown absorbed in the business of organizing WAP. He was glad to feel the anger again, glad to accept its offer of strength, and was just pondering on how he could work this into his speech when a comment from his companion brought a momentary interruption to his thoughts.
"What was that?" asked Limbeck.
"I said it's beautiful, ain't it?" repeated the copper, staring at the Kixi-Winzi in reverent awe. "That does it," thought Limbeck, thoroughly outraged. "When I come before the High Froman, I will tell them the truth."
"Get out!" shouted the teacher, his beard bristling with rage. "Get out, Limbeck Bolt-Tightener, and never let me see those weak eyes of yours in this school again!"
"I don't understand why you're so upset." Young Limbeck rose to his feet.
"Out!"
howled the Geg. "It was a perfectly sound question."
The sight of his instructor rushing at him, upraised, wrench in hand, caused the pupil to beat a swift and undignified retreat from the classroom. 14-turn Limbeck left the Kixi-Winzi school in such haste that he didn't have time to put on his spectacles, and consequently, when he reached the red, creaking cog, he took a wrong turn. The exits were marked, of course, but the nearsighted Limbeck couldn't read the writing. He opened a door he thought led to the corridor that led to the marketplace, got a blast of wind right in the face, and realized that this particular door opened on outside. The young Geg had never been outside. Due to the fearsome storms that swept over the land on the average of one or two an hour, no one ever left the shelter of the town and the comforting presence of the Kixi-Winzi. Rife with tunnels and covered walkways and underground passages, the cities and towns of Drevlin were constructed in such a way that a Geg could go for months without ever feeling a raindrop splash on his face. Those who had to travel used the flash raft or the Gegavators. Few Gegs ever walked outside. Limbeck hesitated on the door stoop, peering nearsightedly into the windswept, rain-drenched landscape. Though the wind blew strongly, there was a lull between storms, and a feeble gray light was strained through the perpetual clouds, as close as Drevlin ever came to basking in the rays of Solaris. The light made the ordinarily gloomy landscape of Drevlin almost lovely. It winked and blinked on the many whirling and pumping and turning arms and claws and wheels of the Kixi-Winzi. It glistened in the clouds of steam rolling up to join their cousins in the skies. It made the dreary and drab landscape of Drevlin, with its gouges and slag heaps and pits and holes, seem almost attractive, particularly if all one could see was a kind of pleasant, fuzzy, mud-colored blur. Limbeck knew at once he had taken a wrong turning. He knew he should go back, but the only place he had to go was home, and he was aware that by now word of his getting kicked out of Kixi-Winzi school would have reached his parents. Braving the terrors of outside was far more attractive than braving the wrath of his father, and so Limbeck, without a second thought, walked outside, letting the door slam shut behind him. Learning to walk in mud was an experience all in itself. On his third step, he slipped and plunked down heavily in the muck. Upon rising, he discovered that one boot was firmly mired, and it took all his strength to tug it out. Peering dimly around, Limbeck concluded that the slag heaps might provide better walking. He slogged his way through the muck and eventually reached the piles of coralite that had been tossed aside by the strong digger hands of the Kixi-Winzi. Climbing up on the hard, pocked surface of the coralite, Limbeck was pleased to note he was right Walking was much easier up here than in the mud. He guessed, too, that the view should be spectacular, and thought he really should see it. Pulling out his spectacles, he hooked them over his ears and gazed around. The smokestacks and holding tanks, lightning-flinging arms, and huge revolving wheels of the Kixiwinzi thrust up from the flat plains of Gremlin, many of them towering so far into the sky that their steaming heads were lost in the clouds. Limbeck stared at the Kixiwinzi in awe. One tended, when one served only one portion of the gigantic creation, to concentrate on just that one part and lose sight of the whole. The old saying about not seeing the wheel for the cogs came to Limbeck's mind. "Why," he asked, which was, by the way, the very question that had caused him to be thrown out of school, "why is the Kixiwinzi here? Why did the Mangers build it and leave it? Why do the immortal Wells come and go every month and never fulfill their promise to lift us up into the shining realms above? Why? The questions beat in Limbeck's head until either these resounding whys, or the wind rushing past him, or the act of staring up at the gleaming structure of the Kixiwinzi, or all three together, began to make him dizzy. Blinking, he took off his spectacles and rubbed his eyes. Clouds were massing on the horizon, but the Geg judged it would be some time yet before another storm swept over the land. If he went home now, a storm of a different sort would sweep over him. Limbeck decided to explore. Fearing he might fall and break his precious spectacles, Limbeck tucked them carefully into the pocket of his shirt and began to make his way across the slag heap. Being short and stocky and deft in their movements, Gegs are remarkably sure-footed. They clump across narrow catwalks built hundreds of feet above the ground without turning a hair on their beards. Gegs, desiring to go from one level to another, will often catch hold of the spokes of one of the huge wheels and ride it up, dangling by their hands from the bottom to the top. Despite the fact that he couldn't see very clearly, Limbeck soon figured out how to traverse the cracked and broken piles of coralite. He was just moving really well and making some headway when he stepped on a loose chunk that tilted and threw him sideways. After that, he had to concentrate on watching his footing, and it was undoubtedly due to this that he forgot to watch the approach of the clouds. It was only when a gust of wind nearly blew him off his feet and drops of rain splattered into his eyes that he remembered the storm. Hastily, Limbeck pulled out his spectacles, put them on, and looked around. He had traveled quite a distance without knowing it. The clouds were swooping down on him, the shelter of the Kixiwinzi was some distance away, and it would take him a long time to retrace his route among the broken coralite. The storms on Drevlin were fierce and dangerous. Limbeck could see blackened holes blown in the coralite from the deadly lightning strikes. If the lightning didn't get him, there was no doubt that the giant hailstones would. And the Geg was just beginning to think that he wouldn't have to worry about facing his father ever again, when, turning completely around, he saw a large something on the fast-darkening horizon. Just what the something was, he couldn't tell from this distance. His spectacles were covered with water, but there was a chance that it might offer shelter from the storm. Keeping his spectacles on, knowing that he would need them to help locate the object, Limbeck tottered and stumbled over the slag heap. Rain began pouring down, and Limbeck soon